Have you ever noticed how we seem to live in a culture of impatience? A culture of impatience. People are frustrated with how slow their internet is, how elderly drivers drive, or how long stoplights seem to be. And we could add a host of other things to the causative factors of our culture of impatience. Think about your last week and how impatience played out in your life. You're pulling into Walmart. You want to make a left turn into a parking spot, and someone is honking behind you. You just like roll down your window and you kind of feel like pointing at the parking spot. I'm going to turn right in there. It's okay. You know, it's okay. Or maybe you're at the grocery store and you've just done your week's shopping and you're putting each item up on the conveyor belt, and this person behind you is like, you know, like they're huffing and sighing because you're trying to eat this week, you know? I mean, they just can't stand that you have 21 items there. Or maybe your kids are whining about summer break. You know, we've had these days of sunshine. I hate school. Why does there have to be 2 more months of school? Why do we have to go to school anyways? I don't mind being uneducated. I want to quit school. And they whine with impatience because of school. Or maybe your boss is overly demanding. Maybe he has these tasks that he's wanted done yesterday, and his edgy emails keep pressuring you day after day because he's impatient. You know, patience often doesn't make our list of most desired virtues in life, does it? I mean, there's not many people who say, oh, just, Lord, I'm just praying for patience. Most people don't pray for that. And you know why, don't you? You know why? Because patience is intrinsically connected to hardship. Patience is organically linked to difficulty. And so not many people will pray for it. Although we may not pray for it, the scriptures teach that patience is essential for the life of every Christian. So my friend, if you're a Christian, you need to learn patience. I mean, if you look in the text I just read, you see this word patience and patient repeated at least 4 times. Like, I wonder what he's going to talk about today. I'm going to talk about patience. Now, notice in verse 7, there's a key word. Be patient, therefore. Now, whenever you see the word therefore, you've heard it said, whenever you see the word therefore, you should ask what it's there for. And so whenever you see therefore, kind of look what precedes it. If you were with us last week, as we examined verses 1 through 6, you realize that the context of this passage about patience, the context of this is a context of oppression, hardship, and suffering. Last week in verses 1 through 6, we saw that there were these unbelieving rich who were oppressing the poor, faithful Christians. You see in those verses leading up to our text today that the believers went hungry. They were even starving, while the rich unbelievers were hoarding food. I mean, it was going bad. They had so much food hoarded, it was going bad while believers were starving. These righteous, poor church members were being denied their due wages, while the rich or the wealthy unbelievers stockpiled wealth. In our text from last week, you see the poor, they're crying out to God because of the oppression and the suffering that they're enduring. But the rich turn a deaf ear and a blind eye to what they're going through. That's what the word therefore is there for. It's to help us remember the context that James isn't just going to talk to people about patience who have never suffered. He's actually talking to people about patience who are in the midst of suffering. And so that frames our message this morning, because if we're really going to understand what James is calling us to do, we have to put it into the context of hardship, oppression, or suffering. So to those of you who suffer, to those of you who have experienced hardship, To those of you who have ever felt oppressed, James speaks to you this morning. And what he does in this text is he identifies three tendencies to avoid and three correlating examples to follow. In other words, when you're in the midst of hardship or you're being oppressed or you're suffering, there's certain tendencies that seem to arise from people like you and me. And James warns us about them. Let me ask you this. When you're going through suffering, you're facing mistreatment, or you're under the weight of oppression, what do you tend towards? What kind of responses do you have? What kind of temptations are directly associated with being in a situation where you're suffering? What are your natural tendencies? Well, James is going to say there's three common mistakes that we need to avoid. Here's the first one. The first one is impatience. Don't be impatient when you face injustice or suffering. Why? Well, because one of the natural tendencies when we go through hardship is to be impatient. That's why the opening of verse 7 simply tells us this: be patient. Why? Well, because our natural tendency is to be impatient. Think of the last time you were having difficulty. Think of the last time you had hardship. Think of the last time you were going through suffering. What did you want? Probably the same thing that I want. Can we please get this suffering done with? Can I please escape this? God, would you let this be over? Because this is hard. Our initial tendency is we want things to get better as soon as possible. We want to push through it, we want to get over it, and we want to get it done. I want to arrive at the destination of rest, peace, ease, justice. That's where I want to be. So get me there quickly. That's how we often feel in times of hardship. But that's not what James tells us to do. James says your natural tendency might be impatience, but instead you need to be patient. That's the first command here. So what is patience? Well, it's this faith-inspired response to adverse circumstances in life. Patience is a faith-inspired response to adverse circumstances in life. In other words, you have faith in God in the midst of your difficulty, and that is what patience is. I am having a faith-filled response towards God in the midst of my hardship. I'm trusting in God in the midst of this difficulty that seems to be crushing me. I'm resting in God. I'm drawing near to God. I'm waiting on the Lord. That's what I'm doing. I'm committing this situation to Him. That's patience. Psalm 37 really puts it in clear terms. Listen as I read what the psalmist says about this faith-inspired response known as patience. Do not fret because of evil men, for they will soon fade like the grass and wither. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust in Him, and He will act. Be still before the Lord, and wait patiently for Him. Do not fret when men succeed in their ways. A little while, and the wicked will be no more. What happens when we face hardship, suffering, and oppression is we get impatient. We get anxious. We get nervous, we get fearful. And what God tells us is we need to get patient. We need to have this faith-inspired response to adverse circumstances where we're waiting on God, we're resting on God, we're being still in the presence of God, we're being quieted and trusting in Him. Patience is not this passive concept of watching a clock tick second by second by second. Have you ever done that? Like, yeah, every Sunday, Lucas. Every Sunday. That's why we strategically put the clock in the back. Have you ever watched a clock tick? I had the worst job of my life when I was in grad school. I worked in a plastics factory in the middle of the night. And every 2.5 minutes, I did the exact same thing. Now, some people actually really love that, but my brain is not wired that way. I mean, some people just enjoy knowing what's going to happen in 2.5 minutes. It's the same thing that happened 2.5 minutes ago. And they find great security in that. And to you, I say, God bless you. But for me, it was like insanity. Because every 2.5 minutes, I would take this piece of plastic off of a hot press. I'd throw it into a cradle. I'd go around it with a palm sander. And then I'd wait for the next piece to come off the press. I did that. Do you know how long 8 hours takes watching the clock every 2.5 minutes? It was like the longest shift in the whole world. And some people think that patience is like watching the clock tick. But that's not patience. Some people think that patience is like when you're in your car and the road crew is doing some construction and the road that you're on, you're trapped from behind and before, and you're waiting because here's this huge road truck that's in the way, and all the guys on the road crew are taking a break and they're eating their peanut butter and jelly sandwiches while traffic is all stopped, and you're like, oh. And first you start to wiggle your foot, you're tapping it underneath the steering wheel, then you begin to tap this, then you begin to adjust the radio, then you look for your phone, oh, I forgot my phone on the nightstand, and you're just going nuts right there while you're waiting on this closed road. And some people think that's patience, like patience is waiting, watching the clock tick, letting time go by while these guys eat their peanut butter and jelly sandwich and don't open the road up. Some people think patience is like waiting for a wound to heal. You just have to let time do its thing. You can't speed up the process. And so some people are frustrated and irritated by this idea of being patient. But it may be because you misunderstand patience. Patience is less like watching the clock tick or waiting for a road truck to get out of the way. It's less like that. And it's more like a marathon runner who gets to mile 6 and knows he has more to go. A marathon runner doesn't get to mile 6 and start screaming in frustration, oh, this is stupid, I have to wait more miles. No, I mean, that's the point. You're in a marathon. They don't get to number 17 and get frustrated, like, oh, it's 17. No, you're in a marathon. They just faithfully endure through this process so that they can finish the course that's been set before them. That's what it's like to be patient. You trust in the end result that God has in store. Stop being frustrated and irritated at the oppression or difficulty or hardship that you're facing. Instead, go through it with patience, trusting in God that He has a finish line in store for you at just the right time. People who are impatient are really struggling with a lack of trust in God. You want to hurry up and fix the situation? You want to hurry up and get over with the suffering? You want to hurry up and have this hardship dissipate? No, my friend, patiently trust in God. That's what James is saying. I mean, the first tendency that we need to avoid in times of suffering is impatience. We need to trust in God. You need to stop saying, God, well, when are you going to do something? I mean, how much is enough, God? Don't you see what's going on here? What am I supposed to do when things are corrupt? This is so unjust. When are you going to step in, God? No. Stop that heart. Instead, run to God and trust Him. People who struggle with patience are often irritated and frustrated people. They're anxious and fearful people. They're people who sometimes take things into their own hands.
Well, I've waited for God, I mean, at least 30 minutes now, and that's it. I'm going to take things into my own hands.
No. Wait on the Lord. Be patient. God is calling these believers who are oppressed and suffering, those believers who are facing injustice, He's telling them, don't be impatient. Have a peace-filled faithfulness in the presence of God and hope in the future that He has in store. So number one, first tendency to avoid, impatience. That's why he says, be patient. Second tendency to avoid in this text is the tendency of faint-heartedness, losing heart in the midst of suffering, in the midst of hardship. Notice verse number 8. Look at what James tells us in this text. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Establish your hearts. Don't become discouraged. Don't become depressed. Don't lose heart in the midst of this circumstance. Isn't that easy to do? For any of us in here who have suffered for any length of time, it is easy to lose heart. To lose heart is to lose your motivation, your enthusiasm. To lose heart is to get to a point where you feel like, I just can't do this anymore. And you kind of just throw your hands up. That's what it means to lose heart. He says, no. Establish your heart. Don't lose heart. Have you ever watched someone go through deep difficulty and lose heart? I had a niece some years ago. She's passed away now. But she had cystic fibrosis. And it got so bad, she got to a point where she needed a lung transplant. She qualified. She was matched. And she got new lungs. And the family, we were really rejoicing at this. It was kind of like a miracle that Jenny got these new lungs and kind of gave her new hope for life. It was a number of months that went by, and she started to get some sort of pneumonia setting in. They thought, well, we have to treat this. Well, as we heard the news, we found out, no, it's actually her body is rejecting the lungs. I got a call from a family member. They said, just pray for Jenny. She just has decided not to eat anymore. She's just kind of giving up. You know what? She lost heart. No more enthusiasm, no more motivation. The suffering's too hard. This text says, don't do that. I know you might want to give up. I know you might want to quit. I know this may be the hardest thing you've ever gone through. But establish your hearts. Don't lose your motivation. Don't lose your enthusiasm. This phrase, establish your heart, this was used to speak to women who were going through labor. You say, Lucas, you have no idea what you're talking about, so just stop the discussion. All right, but I've been there 4 times. I mean, stood there. You've never been there. I stood there. This one particular instance, I ate a gyro, a big Greek gyro, right before my wife went into labor. That was a big mistake. Don't do that. She's like, I can smell the gyro coming out of your pores. Get away from me. I'm like, sorry. It was really good, you know. That has nothing to do with the sermon. It was about don't lose heart. And it was used of women who were in labor. And you're there at the bedside. They're going through these painful contractions. And they say, I can't do this anymore. I can't do this. And you're like, honey, you can do this. It's gonna, and then she grabs you by the throat and says, you did this to me! You know, I mean, but they're in the midst of something painful and something difficult, and they feel like they can't do it. That's what it means to lose heart. And what James is saying here is you may be in a situation where you're going through difficulty, and it might be painful. It might be the hardest thing you've ever faced. And he says, establish your hearts. Don't lose your heart. Stand firm. Have a steely resolve to carry on in the face of adversity. That's what it means to establish your heart. Be set and be fixed on what God is taking you through and continue in it. This word establish was a word that was used to describe Jesus when it says he established his face to go to Jerusalem. Or in other words, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. If you remember the context of that, he's getting ready to go to Jerusalem to be crucified. He was going to do something very hard, and yet he set himself. He established himself. The word was also used of soldiers. They had to be established in the face of battle. No running, no desertion. They couldn't lose heart in times of suffering. And that's what James is telling us here. Number one, avoid impatience. Number two, avoid faint-heartedness. Here's the third and final thing he says to avoid. Avoid the tendency of complaining. Ooh, that one's practical. Thanks, James, for really getting it down to our level. Because when we go through hard things, one of our first responses is to grumble and complain. Just check Facebook. The complain fest. All the things you don't like in life. All the things you disagree with. All the things you can't stand. You post them. All those phone calls that if we could monitor the phone calls, they're you calling your friend to whine and complain. Because life is hard. Because you're suffering. Because you're oppressed in some way. Look at verse number 9. Let's just be real clear. Do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. In other words, if you're a grumbler and you're a complainer, if you're calling your friend in the church to whine and complain about things you don't like, you will be judged. That's what it says. Stop it. You say, yeah, but it's hard. You don't understand. This is difficult. You don't understand. This is oppressive. No, I think James does understand. And he says, stop complaining. Stop your grumbling. The Lord knows. I mean, let's just take that word grumbling all the way back to the Israelites. And when the people complained, it displeased the Lord, and the Lord heard it. Have you read the book of Exodus? These people are grumblers and they're complainers the whole way through. And in their grumbling and their complaining, they may have thought they were grumbling and complaining against Moses. Like, Moses, you're directionally challenged. Why are we in the wilderness? Can you get a compass? Moses, could we get some real food here? Because I'm sick and tired of this manna. I don't like bread. Hey, Moses, maybe get us to some water because it's hot here and we're thirsty. Moses. But you know what? They weren't really complaining against Moses. Do you know, in their grumbling and their complaining, who are they really complaining against? Who are they really whining about? Say it. God. And so do we. So do we. When we whine and grumble and complain, we're actually complaining against God. Here are these people, and they are being treated unjustly. Remember, their employers were not paying them. They were deeply suffering. Some of them were facing starvation, while the rich people who owed them money were hoarding food and wealth. Do you remember that? I mean, it's almost like they have valid things. That's what we feel like inside. Yeah, but it's valid. Yeah, but this is for real. Yeah, but he says stop complaining. Because in some way our complaining is connected to our God, who is the great provider, who actually sees and knows your suffering. That's what he's saying here. You know what else is interesting to me? These rich unbelievers were the source of the oppression. But what did these poor believers do? If you notice that verse, they complained to one another. I just thought that's interesting. How many times do we complain to people who can do nothing about it? You whine, gossip, and slander on the phone and complain to someone who can do nothing about your problem. They're not part of the problem. They're not part of the solution. And you still do it. We post it up on Facebook for the whole world to see, except for the people that can actually do something. It doesn't do it. My friends, that's not where you bring your complaints. If you have a concern because of oppression, you feel like you're going through hardship, where should you bring your complaints to? Where? To God. Prayerless people complain to others instead of bringing their needs to God. You want to look at a grumbler and a complainer, you will find a prayerless person because they don't know where to bring their complaints. It's kind of like, that's not the right office. That's not the office for your oppression and your disturbance and your feelings like you're in hardship. The right office to bring it to is His. Take your anxieties, take your cares and cast them on Him. He cares for you, my friend. These people, they're complaining to one another when really they should be praying to God. And so what James says here, listen, in the midst of suffering, avoid impatience, faint-heartedness, and complaining. Now, those are the three things to avoid. But But he then gives us three examples to follow. He kind of connects them with some examples. So in this text, you will find that there's a farmer. You will find that there are prophets, and you will find the individual named Job. So three examples to follow. Here's the first one. In times of suffering, we shouldn't be impatient, but rather imitate the farmer. And you see that in verses 7 and 8. Verse 7, be patient therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it, until he receives the early and late rains. You also be patient. Do you see that? Be patient like the farmer. I have a deep respect for farmers. Most of us couldn't keep their work schedules, and most of us don't have their hearts of patience. Because what is it to be a farmer? He says here he's having to wait for the early and late rains. Basically, you put those seeds in while it's dry, and you hope for the early rains to help those seeds germinate and the late rains to help those roots grow and those plants to thrive and flourish. A farmer has to wait. You ever seen a crazy farmer? You're like, yeah, I know a crazy farmer. His name's Uncle Al, and he lives out in Minnesota. And no, have you ever seen a crazy farmer who can't wait? I mean, he's out in the middle of his field. He's kicking up dust. He's like, oh, I hope the rain comes. I hope the rain comes. I mean, what a senseless existence for months of kicking up dust. Where you see this farmer, and he's like biting all of his dirty fingernails. Oh, I know this has been in horse manure, but it's okay. I'm so nervous. He's biting all of his fingernails because he's so nervous, wondering if there's going to be rain. You ever seen a farmer? He's awake at night staring at the ceiling like, I know we're in summer, but boy, I sure hope those early and late rains come. I don't know if I can sleep. No, my friend, that's insanity. If you're going to be a farmer, you better learn patience, my friend. And that's what he says here. You're suffering. You're going through hardship. Life is difficult. You need to be like the farmer who has learned patience. What's necessary for farming is to wait with hopeful expectations. These rains in this passage, they represent the blessing of the Lord in God's time. Right? Where do raindrops come from? They come from the heavens. It's a blessing of the Lord. So here's this farmer who has learned patience, and he's waiting on the blessing of the Lord in the Lord's time. He has to learn to submit to God's timetable. Some of our impatience is really a lack of submission to God. We don't like his timing. We don't like endurance. We don't want to wait. But like the farmer, we need to learn to submit to God with hopeful expectation. We need to wait on his hidden timetable. We need to trust in his goodness so that when he sees fit, he will rain down blessings from heaven. He will quench the dryness of our hearts. He will cause fresh life to grow where there was hardship and difficulty. But we learn the patience of the farmer, and we trust God. That's the first example, he says. Here's the second example. It's the example of the prophets. It's in verse number 10. Take a look at verse number 10. As an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. I wonder how many of us would sign up on Indeed app, the job finding app, for a prophet position. Now I'm looking for a prophet position. I wonder if there's any of those open and available. I wonder what that sort of job entails. Let me tell you what the prophet position job entails. It means definite ridicule, severe rejection, possible imprisonment, and probable death. Oh, yeah, sign me up. That prophet thing sounds like a great gig. I mean, my friends, remember the prophets of old? They're speaking in the name of the Lord to the people of Israel. You get to Jeremiah chapter 38, and Jeremiah the prophet is cast into a cistern. You get to 1 Kings 22, and Micaiah is put in prison. You get to Amos chapter 7, and Amos is run out of town. You get to Matthew chapter 23, and it says that Zechariah was killed. The people ignored their prophecies. They were often hostile to these prophets and even murderous to most of them. Can you imagine what it would be like to be a prophet? It'd be pretty easy to be faint-hearted, wouldn't it? Like, wow, this is a hard task. I don't think I can do this anymore. This prophet thing, I think I've tried it once and I'm done. Be easy to quit being a prophet. But do you know what God did to these prophets? He actually established their hearts so that they could endure and suffer over time. Let me give you a for instance. It's in the book of Ezekiel, one of the prophets. Ezekiel chapter 3, verse 7 says, "The house of Israel will not be willing to listen to you." Isn't that a great start to your job? I'm calling you to be a prophet. And by the way, no one's going to listen. "The house of Israel will not be willing to listen to you, for they are not willing to listen to me, because all the house of Israel have a hard forehead and a stubborn heart. Behold, I have made your face as hard as their faces, and your forehead as hard as their forehead. Like emery, harder than flint, have I made your forehead." He's talking to Ezekiel. "Fear them not, nor be dismayed at their looks." What did God do? He actually established the heart of Ezekiel so that Ezekiel could do hard things and not lose heart. He could go and deal with hard situations and not become faint-hearted. Being a prophet was not easy. They needed to have a heart that was established in the Lord. Don't quit. Don't bail. Don't waver. Finish the course. Wait on the Lord. That's what the prophets needed. And so in this text, James says, listen, in times of suffering, don't grow faint-hearted. Instead, imitate the prophets of old who spoke in the name of the Lord, even in the midst of difficulty. One last example to follow. It's in verse number 11. Take a look at verse number 11. Notice the biblical character from the Old Testament that James surfaces as an example to us this morning. "Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. You've heard of the steadfastness of Job. And you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful." If anyone had a right to complain, it seems like it would be Job. But James is telling us here, in times of suffering, don't complain. Rather, imitate Job. Although he may have had every right to complain, he actually remained steadfast and patient in the midst of his suffering. There's a liturgy from over in the UK. A minister would say this: "May God give you the wisdom of Solomon, the faith of Abraham, the insight of Daniel, the courage of David, and the patience of Job." The patience of Job. A man who could have complained, but didn't at the most expected time. Do you remember Job's story? He's an Old Testament character. He was the wealthiest man in the East. That's what the scriptures say. It says his wealth surpassed all of those in the East. He was a wealthy man, but he was also a spiritual man. Job was a man who loved God. This is what it says in Job 1:8. He was blameless and upright, a man who feared God, who shunned evil. And so in the story of Job, as the book unfolds, you realize there's Satan, and he looks at Job. He's a wealthy man. He's a godly man. And Satan says this: "You want to know why he's a godly man? He's a godly man because he's a wealthy man." In other words, sure, it's easy to give thanks to God when everything's going right, when life is easy, when your bank account is inflated, when work is going well and business is prospering. Sure, it's easy to give thanks to God. But this Job, if you would take away his blessing, if you would remove these luxuries, if you would give him some suffering and some hardship, do you know what Job will do? He'll curse you. That's what Satan said to God. And so God allowed Satan to take away these privileges, to remove some of these blessings, to cause things to wilt and fade away, to be robbed and to die, right from underneath Job. Satan said, "You've blessed the work of his hands so that the flocks and the herds are spread throughout the land. But stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and surely he will curse you to your face." That's what Satan said in Job 1, verses 10 and 11. So the Lord let Job suffer. The Lord let him be oppressed. The Lord let Job be crushed by pressures and trials of life. I know we brought in some pressures and trials of life this morning. But is there anyone here who can stand and say, I've read Job chapter 1 and my pressures and my trials exceed his? Is there anyone who can do that? Well, go ahead, pressure his life, let things crumble. Surely he will curse you to his face. So God allows these trials to happen in Job's life. He allows Satan to do this. But how does Job respond? Does he complain? Does he curse God to his face? No, in Job chapter 1, verse 20, it says this. Then he fell to the ground in worship and said, naked I came into this world and naked I shall return. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And what we often do is we complain and curse. What we need to learn to do is to worship and bless the name of the Lord. Job didn't curse, complain, or grumble. He worshiped. In the midst of his pain, he was pushed towards God. I often ask people, I meet with people in pain all week long in counseling. And I often ask people, where is your pain pushing you? Because pain always pushes us somewhere. Might push you to anger, might push you to alcohol. It might push you to shopping, or it might push you to drugs. It might push you to, and you fill in the blank, but your pain pushes you somewhere. Many times it pushes us to complain. But here in this, we're learning from the life of Job as an example. It needs to push us to God. We need to learn to worship. Job was not a perfect man. He had a lot of questions. He agonized over the whys. But at the end of the day, when his wife comes to him and says, curse God and die, Job. Job says, you are like one of the silly women. Shall we receive blessing from the hand of God, and shall we also not receive adversity? Job learned to trust in the goodness of God, both in times of prosperity, but also in times of pain. So in this section, in times of suffering, we need the patience of a farmer, the steadfast heart of the prophets, and we need to refuse to grumble like Job. Now, we could end the message and just say, well, do this, don't do that, follow this example, emulate this historical character, go in peace. And we would be out of here before noon for the very first time in Gospel Grace history. But you all know that it's not enough just to emulate a historical character. It's not enough just to create a list of do this, don't do that. Instead, we need to ask questions like, why should we follow the example of the farmer, the prophets, or Job? Why shouldn't we be impatient or faint-hearted or complaining? Those seem to be the most natural things to do. Why? Well, the answer is twofold. Number one, the reason why you should follow the example of the farmer, the prophets, and Job, the reason why you should not be impatient, faint-hearted, or complaining, the reason why is because the Lord is coming. That's what this text says. Look at this text, verse number 7, verse number 8, verse number 9. James says the motivation for living this way is actually the coming of the Lord. Notice verse 7, until the coming of the Lord. Notice verse 8, the coming of the Lord is at hand. Notice verse 9, the judge is standing at the door. The coming of the Lord assures those who are suffering unjustly that things will be set right in the end. Do you see? This is important that you get this. It's not enough to just be like, well, I'm going to be like Job today. Well, wonderful, you're not going to be like Job. Boy, I'm going to try to be like the prophets. I'm going to do better. No, my friends, remember this. In the midst of your suffering, your hardship, and whatever oppression you're facing, remember this. The Lord is coming. And he will set all things right. Let that comfort your heart this morning. They may have their way for a time. They may have their laughs for a while. But the judge is standing at the door. When I was in high school, 10th grade specifically, we moved from New York to Maryland. Had to change schools. In Maryland, I went to a much larger school, just under 3,000 students. It was a large school. I was from a small town. We were poor. I was a nerd. I was a slow bloomer. I remember specifically, because there's a picture of me in the yearbook, where we're at a football game, and we were all going to write letters on our chests, you know? And all the guys are like this, except for me, I was like this, because I was a slow bloomer. And I didn't want anybody to notice that, like, no, I don't shave. It just hasn't come in yet, you know? So I can remember, I got this yearbook picture, and I'm like this, you know? I was skinny, I was small, we were poor, I had big glasses and a bad haircut, and I still hadn't figured out that you don't need to carry every book to every class. And I started at this new school, and in this one particular period in between classes, right at the beginning of school, there was some football idiot that thought it would be funny. I didn't even know him, and he didn't know me, but every day he thought it'd be funny to shove me into the lockers. So I'm just this little kid trying to carry all my books to every class with my hair like in my face and my big glasses like weighing me down. And some idiot has to push me into the lockers every day. And you know, you do it once and you're like, boy, that was inconsiderate. And you do it twice and you're like, boy, that's a bother. And you do it three times and you're like, this has to stop. And so I told my older brother that there was someone doing this. My older brother was the captain of the varsity wrestling team. And somehow, in between one of these classes, he happened to have a detour. Now, I don't know what he actually did. Maybe he shoved that guy into a locker. Maybe he turned him upside down into a trash can and taped his hairy legs with some duct tape and then ripped it off. I don't know what he did. Those are the things I was dreaming of, you know. I'm not sure what he did, but he did something that day, and it never happened again. And I thought, yeah, that's right. You don't touch me, you know. Older brother will get you. That's right, you know. That's how you feel. Do you know that there are some people who are deeply suffering? I mean, in life, they are being shoved against the lockers by oppression, by people who are wrong, by people who are sinning against them, robbing them, taking advantage of them, being unfair with them. There are things in life that just aren't right, and it's happening again and again and again. And you know what James says? God is going to walk down that hall and say, the judge is standing at the door. So take comfort, brothers and sisters. The Lord is coming. Do you know more than 300 times in the New Testament it says that? The Lord is coming. The Lord is coming. The coming of the Lord is at hand. Remember the coming of the Lord. Let it bring comfort to you, believer, and let it strike fear in the heart of every unbeliever. The coming of the Lord motivates us in times of suffering and oppression not to be impatient, not to lose heart, not to grumble or complain. The Lord is coming. One more motivating factor, and that is this. The Lord is loving. The Lord is coming. The Lord is loving. Look at verse number 11. The Lord is compassionate and merciful. My friends, when you're hurting, you're wondering about that. Where's the mercy? Where's the compassion? I'm hurting. This doesn't seem to end. If God's so loving, why is he letting me go through this? My friend, God is so loving that if you're a believer, he will not let you go through that forever. I'm going to say that again. God is so loving. If you're a believer, he will not let you go through that forever. Pause for a second. As a sinner, what do you really deserve? I mean, sometimes we talk about, well, my rights. They're violating my rights. This is so unfair. This isn't just. Do you want justice, my friend? Do you want what you rightly deserve? The wages of sin is, say it, death. That's what you deserve. There's your right. You want your paycheck? Burn in hell forever. Suffer in the torments of the lake of fire forever. Do you see what I mean? Do you know, sometimes in the midst of suffering, we're like, well, God isn't loving. Oh, my friend, he is more loving than you can even imagine. He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also with him give us all good things? He has promised and he has made a way to deliver you from suffering. to deliver you from oppression. The glorious nature of the gospel is this. If you are a Christian and you've been saved by the grace of God through faith in him, if he has forgiven your sins, do you know what your hope is? You may suffer for 70 years here. You may have the worst life possible here, but you will have glory for eternity. There will be a time when there is no more pain and no more sorrow and no more tears. My friends, I sit sometimes each week with people who are so hurting. They're so bruised and battered by life. You know, in Matthew chapter 9, it says Jesus looks at these people and he has compassion because they're like sheep that are harassed by life. My friend, this life is hard. That is why you need Jesus. This life is unbearable. Sometimes you don't want another breath. You're like, God, I know I got to breathe, but I don't really want another one. It is hard and it is painful, but my friend, hope in God. Eternity is a place where he will take pain and he will put it away. And he will take tears and he will wipe them away. And you will be in his presence for eternity. He is a compassionate and merciful God because he will not let you suffer under this oppression and pain forever. He will actually let you be in his presence with joy and rejoicing forever. My friends, it was through his stripes that we have been healed. Right before the sermon today, I was just reflecting on Romans 8. What can we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own son, he gave him up for us all. How will he not also with him graciously give us all good things? Who can bring any charge against God's elect? It is God who justifies. Who is to condemn? Christ Jesus is the one who died, and more than that, who was raised, who is at the right hand of God. He is indeed interceding for us. Who can separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation? Shall distress, persecution, famine, nakedness, danger, sword? No. In all these things, we are more than conquerors through him who, what? Loved us. I am sure that neither death, nor angels, nor rulers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor anything else in all of creation will be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord. The Lord is coming, and the Lord is loving. Hope in him. My friends, when we face the trials and suffering of life, let us remember those two things. He's coming, he's loving. And let that motivate us not to be impatient, not to lose heart, not to complain, but instead be like the farmer, the prophets, and Job, who persevered with their eyes fixed